The Lessons of Samson's Life.
The outline is divided into two sides. The first side is based pretty much upon the reprint article that's referenced to give us a foundation from which to study the second side. The second side is, if the premises that are laid in the first side are correct, then how do we apply these in the overall study of Samson's life? The first thing we want to look at, though, I think is a very key text. Judges 14:4. And probably we should read 1 through 4, although 4 is the one we're discussing, just to get a basis of understanding of how Samson's life operates. I think we often emphasize his weaknesses, and this text suggests us a little different additional thought. Judges 14, 1-4. Sister Marie Hack, please.
But his father and his mother knew not.
Start at verse 1. 1 through 4.
Oh. And Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. And he came up and told his father and his mother and said, I have seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me to wife. Then his father and his mother said unto him, Is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren, or among all my people, that thou goest to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said unto his father, Get her for me, for she pleaseth me well. But his father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord that he sought an occasion against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel.
Okay. What do you think verse 4 is telling us about at least this instance in Samson's life? It may not be true of all the instances, but at least this instance. Why is this verse inserted into the record? Joe, may I guess? Okay, that it was not then something that just happened. It wasn't purely a case of looking at the woman, but also he saw the Lord's hand. Marge?
Well, Samson was... Samson knew that if he went out and did something against the Philistine, there would be retaliation against Israel. Trump up a provocation in which the Philistines would see he had a good personal vendetta to carry out for what they had done, then it would be taken as a personal thing and not something to retaliate against Israel as a whole.
Okay. Good comment. Any other comments? In this verse, how do you interpret the word he? His father knew not that it was of the Lord that he sought an occasion against the Philistines. He, Samson, or he, the Lord? Brother Victor.
I think even Samson don't know why the Lord was directing him in that particular instant, and parents either don't know why. But later on, Samson find out what the Lord told him to the angel, what to do and how to do.
Okay. Sister Millie?
Can I read it?
Yes. We do have a little problem with our microphone here today.
His father and his mother did not know that it was from the Lord.
I thought maybe I could do without. His father and his mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel.
And who do you take the he as being? Samson was seeking an occasion, or the Lord was seeking an occasion?
I think the father and mother didn't know it, but I think the Lord was seeking an occasion to deal with the Philistines, probably in favor, not that it would hurt them. It would try to heal the wound rather than to.
Okay. Any additional thoughts? Andy Weeks in the back.
speaking of Samson, because I have never read before where the Lord sought an opportunity. He usually just created his own.
Okay, that's a good point. The Lord has the ability to create it. But Samson, perhaps in the motive Marge suggested of trying to avert the retaliation, instead of being against the nation, he took it against himself. And that I tend to think that probably is what we have here, is that it really is speaking of Samson was doing this not so much because of his attraction to this particular woman, but because he saw in this an opportunity to bring a situation to bear that would affect the deliverance of Israel. Do you think the same motivation can be transferred from this story about this woman in Timnath to Delilah, to Gaza, to the other incidents in Samson's life, that instead of looking at the motivation purely his flesh, that there may have been partly his desire to redeem Israel, to deliver them? How do you feel? Sister Sophie.
He was a man of God, and in fact he was a Nazarite, so he was dedicated to the Lord.
Okay, that I think is a very good point to keep in mind, and perhaps along that same line it's good to just reread Hebrews 11, verse, near the end of the chapter, 32 is it? Yes, 11:32. Ollie, do you have that there? He was 11:32.
And what shall I? More shall I say? For the time will fail me to tell of Gideon, of Barak, of Samson, of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel and the prophets.
So he is listed as an ancient worthy. And therefore, we have him listed as a person more of faith than of weakness. Not saying everything he did is right, but that I think that recognition needs to be there. Brother George?
Well, I was thinking of a precedent as to, you know, when we think of him being an ancient worthy and going to a harlot, the two don't go hand in hand. But I was thinking the book of Hosea starts in chapter 1, verse 2, and when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry," etc. And all of this was being done as a picture and as a lesson. So it could have very well been that all three of these events were really directed. It doesn't say specifically with Samson that the Lord directed him to go to the harlot, but it did of Hosea. And it could have been that the Lord directed Samson to do this too.
Okay, so that possibility exists. Donna? Donna Cook. I guess we're stuck to one microphone, huh? I think we're going to have to put Dan to double duty.
Samson wanted to take her to be his wife.
Okay.
Not just to go to a harlot.
Yeah, that's true.
Although she was one.
You do have one later. You have one of Gaza.
Give her for me to wife.
I think this is an interesting scripture to defend the conclusion Brother Russell is going to arrive at in the next two quotations, because he suggests that Samson pictures whom? In this reprint article. The church. And so you don't like to think of the church as being basically bad. Weak sometimes, yes, but not as being basically a bad item. And this text gives us a little bit of support for that. Let's get into the article, into these two quotations from the article. This first quotation, Sister Irene, would you read that for us, Irene Denisky? It's the quotation, you have the sheet there.
Yes.
Is there not in some respects?
Is there not in some respects an analogy between the experiences of Samson and the experiences of the Church of Christ? Consider the activities of the early church and the victories they gained in the name and strength of the Lord. Consider how the adversary entangled and seduced the church and how for a considerable time the stupor and drowsiness and ease and worldliness were upon those who vowed to be faithful to the Lord and His service. Consider how the strength of the gospel message was lost while in that drowsy condition in the dark ages. Consider how the eyes of our understanding were put out even as Samson lost his natural sight. Consider that ever since the Reformation time, the church has been to a large extent under the blinding influence of the adversary, a slave to churchianity and the world, even as Samson was the slave of the Philistines. As their slave, Samson was used instead of a horse to turn a great wheel for grinding their food. And thus indeed the church has been grinding food of a certain kind for the many while still a slave in the world and under the blinding influences.
Okay. Can anyone sort of, in their own words, give us the analogy that Brother Russell is drawing in this section of the article? What picture is he drawing it from in Samson's life, and just primarily, what is he saying that this picture is showing to him? I see a hand in the back. I don't see a face. Will that hand please answer? Joy, thank you.
Well, the analogy is the experiences of the church in the gospel, well, of course, in the gospel age, and how it was enslaved to the powers that be, and as a result was greatly weakened. But some of it was its own foolishness, too, that caused it.
Okay, it let itself become lured into drowsiness. What were some of the lures that it accepted, giving it that drowsy feeling? Sister Ali.
It could be the indulgences which forgave their sins.
Okay, the lack of accountability for personal sin. In fact, you could buy yourself off after it was over. Mom?
There would be the accountability for lack of personal study, too, because the clergy were supposed to do all the thinking for them, and they just accepted what the clergy had said.
Okay, the entire concept of the priesthood. The Reformation call was the priesthood of all believers as in exchange. Walter Jurek?
The enticements of the
world. Okay, worldliness, the ease, the sense of ease. As long as the church was persecuted, it was spiritually strong. But when it came, when it found its Delilah, it became prosperous and it couldn't handle that. Any other enticements that were there that lured to drowsiness? Lorraine?
I was wondering if it would be like the monarchs and the kings that had control over them.
Okay. That here again you had the abdication of personal responsibility. I think it all boils down to that. That wherever personal responsibility is forfeited, you have drowsiness, ease coming in, and sleep. Do you notice when do the enemy sow tares in the parable of the wheat and tares? Donna? While men slept. When they got themselves get into a drowsy condition, when they were no longer alert, then the sowing the tares. What was the equivalent of the cutting off of the hair? And the loss of strength. Joy again?
When he stopped living up to his covenant of being a Nazarite.
Right. Okay. It's hard to think of Nazarite and Nazarene. Nazarite is the vow that's here. Okay, that's a great part of it. Loss of responsibility to his covenant. Anything else? What does hair picture? Covering. And as a covering, what is a picture? Submissive to somebody higher, a headship. When the headship was abdicated to the church, and the church became the one to make the decisions, then you had its spiritual head cut off and was replaced with another head. What does the blinding correspond to? Andy?
There's a good example in Revelation 2 where he warns them about leaving their first love, and he says, or else I am coming to you and remove your lampstand out of its place.
Okay. That's very good. Anyone else? Further on the blinding. He talks about it in the paragraph. Mom?
Well, it would be the blinding of the eyes of their understanding, because they're not studying, they're not trying to learn, they're just accepting what someone else says to them.
When you accept the word from the pulpit, you are no longer thinking. And therefore, if the pulpit is blind, the follower is going to be blind. You cannot go above. Joy? Okay, Joyce, because was there a choice available? Who's got a thought on Joyce's question? Was it not inevitable?
Well, I didn't know if the Bibles were available to them, you know. What would they study? That's really a question for information.
Okay. Anyone have a thought on that? Since the Bibles are chained to the pulpit, what option did they have? Richard?
Well, Brother Carl, at the time the church went blind, we're looking at the period around in the 300s, where they had the great church councils, where it was decided that God was a Trinity and that sort of thing. And Bibles were available to middle class people at that point in time. They were mass produced at scriptoriums, where one reader would read the text and there'd be 50 copyists making a copy, and it was available. And today it might be considered, you know, maybe like the cost of getting a set of reprints or something, but they were available and they chose to pursue their own vain philosophies. After that, when the barbarians swept over Europe and destroyed the centers of learning, then reading became a rare thing. But the church was way off the track during a period of time where they could read fluently. And for the Byzantine Empire, they continued to read fluently into Greek until 1,000 years later. And they were so far off the track, they never even managed a Reformation.
Perhaps to that can also be adduced the evidence that at all times you had some separatists from the big church systems who met in little conclaves and groups, and who maintained a surprising degree of truth. I was impressed in Frome's work on immortality, where he says that there was at all times a remnant who refused to give in to the concept of the immortal soul, eternal torment, Trinity even. He doesn't say that in that book, but that's also true. That at all times you've got some who have enough independence in their research and study to do that. So, Joy, I think probably the answer is, while they were not freely available, you couldn't go to Crox and Brentano's, they were nevertheless available for those who truly sought them. Do you have anything further, Joy?
Read.
Brother Richard was saying that reading was quite prominent at that time, you said? I didn't know that. That was new to me, too, Rich. Can you elaborate more on that, Richard?
The church went from Greek speaking to Latin speaking in the 300s, but it was still common for people of modest means to be educated and for slaves to be educated. And we find the church getting themselves into a morass in the 300s and the 400s, and then you had the barbarian invasions, the sack of Rome, and so forth, the time of troubles that swept over Europe for about four centuries following that. But the church was well off the track before the barbarian invasions fell upon them, and they were in a position to read at that point in time.
I think probably that while you have illiteracy at a much higher rate than today, Nevertheless, all educated people were not part of the clergy. And therefore, you did have groups that could read, and you discussed with others, too. Anybody? Ted Martin?
I think if you look at the historical accounts of the Council of Nicaea, you see that at that time there was a disagreement as to the Trinity. And so it shows that there was understanding on both sides. It seems like there was an abdication by the majority to the pressure of the government and those who were more popular in their beliefs. And so it seems to me that if you look and see that there was a division amongst the even the clergy, that there was understanding, correct understanding, and it seems like it was just overruled by a majority who abdicated their responsibilities.
I think that is a good point to keep in mind, because many of the believers through the century were in the church, and they had those had the education and the availability. Additional? Brother Victor Gadelis.
Church was pure until the apostles was living. When the apostles fell asleep in death, then came worldly tears and false teachers start teaching many different doctrines. And 303 to 313, it was worse persecution for the Church of Smyrna because of the false teachers. They was accused for many things which they don't do it. There was, and then later on, the worldly church seized the most control over them. But here and there was still little groups was believed as the apostles left.
Okay. Anything further? Joy, anything further yourself? And
thank you.
Okay. Yes, Sister Wanda.
I was referring to Isaiah 55:11, and we know that their truth, though not as bright during those early, not the early years, but before the dark time, we are told in the scripture, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing wherein I sent it. And the Lord gave out the light. Therefore, we are assured there was some light throughout all the ages.
Okay. Let's go on to the next quotation. Now, this first quotation, from the time of his writing of the article, he's looking backward, and he says, we can see a general picture of Samson to the true church in the past. And he's going from the point of his grinding at the mill on back. Now, in the next quotation, he's going future. He's saying, based upon the past, we anticipate the following from the Samson picture. We suggest that quotation. Sister Iona, would you read that for us?
We suggest that the scriptural delineations of the future correspond in many respects with the picture given us in the life of Samson. Have we not come to the time when the Lord's people are recovering a little of the strength of the early church? And have we not also come to the time when the worldly wise are feasting and rejoicing and giving honor to the God of evolution? And through their higher critics denouncing the true Israelites and their hopes and the divine testimonies? Have we not come very near to the time when those who are still faithful to the Lord and the principles of His Word are made sport of by the worldly wise? And have we not come to the time when some at least of the Lord's true people are ready to put forth all the strength in their power through the volunteer work and the co-operative work, the pilgrim work, and a thousand other energies to move the pillars of error which uphold churchianity?
Okay. What are the events in Samson's life that he's referring to here as a future picture? Sister Sophie.
Well,
I think this would be the time after he had his hair cut and his power was lost, and then he regained some of that power.
Okay, what gave him back his power? Mom? Prayer? He said prayer?
Yes. He okay. prayed the Lord for the strength to do it.
He prayed to the Lord for strength, okay. Prayer was very strong. And, Andy? Prayer and hair. Okay. These are the two secrets that he had. Maybe he prayed for hair. Because the hair again came back, and with it came his strength. What is pictured by the recovery of his hair and therefore his power? Strongly implied in the article we looked at. Mark Tabak?
Well, as Brother Russell pointed out, it was a, at the end of the age here, kind of revitalizing, a renewal of the church, seeking to serve the Lord more faithfully. And that corresponds to Samson's hair growth and desire, increased desire to serve God.
Okay, I think that's a good start. Any additional comments on the regrowth of the hair and the power that went with it? Marge, you have a thought?
Yes, but I don't think you're going to like my thought.
Go ahead.
I can see the point about the hair growing back and his strength with it and how the church is revitalized at the end of the age, but are we also still blind?
Okay, we're going to hold that part of it. That's a very good point. Richard?
In line with this part of the discussion, we point out that when Pastor Russell was on the scene, he looked forward in faith to the reestablishment of the State of Israel and the hopes for seeing them achieve nationhood in 1914 weren't met. They were met subsequently, and we've had the privilege of seeing statehood actually take place. I think if you look at the life of Samson, you will see more relevant parallels to the reestablishment of Israel and what the role they play in bringing down the Gentile systems. You'll see parallels to the church, nominal, in that the experiences of fleshly Israel were a type in ways of the experiences that would befall the gospel age church. But I think we may be focusing on the wrong issue. I think Samson's life looks more to me like a type of Israel.
Okay. Let's hold that as a parallel thought. Right now, let's follow through the thought on the paragraph we're discussing, then come back to that thought. Here he's suggesting that the secret to power is what? Besides hair. Joy?
I think our power always has to be the strength of our consecration, and that's what it was. The hair was a part of the covenant.
Okay, it was a reassertion of the covenant vows he'd taken, going back to those. That's a very important part of it. Mom?
I think it was his renewed zeal for the Lord and serving him.
Okay, reasserting the headship of God. That's what the hair pictured originally. There was a headship of another higher power. And this was given to the church, nominal, as we say in the paragraphs. And now, at the end of the age, it's given back to God. The hair is growing again, that assertion of the headship there. And that is, as Joy said, that's the covenant. Our covenant is to keep the Lord first, to do His will, and not somebody's interpretation of His will. But if this thought of the coming back of the hair is, as the paragraph suggests, showing the strength in the church, what about the points Mr. Marge raises about he's still blind? And Richard said, doesn't that indicate maybe something like Israel instead? What is your thought? How does the blindness, the continued blindness, his strength comes back, the blindness remains? I think that covers your question, doesn't it, Marge? Okay. Any comments on that question? Yeah, we're not getting an abundance of comments, so we've got one now, Joy.
Well, I wish the other brethren had guessed, too, because probably their guesses are just as good as mine. But I'm going to guess that the picture could change here because you can't really carry it out all the way, type to antitype or picture to what follows.
Okay.
But we are still imperfect in the flesh. And so we can't really say that it's because of our perfection that it's going to happen. It's totally the Lord giving us the strength.
Okay. Additional. Frida?
Aren't we walking by faith instead of sight?
Okay. But he was made blind through his own folly. Of course, sometimes our own folly is there too. Additional comments. Alice?
Well, I like Richard's thought better, but he did get to the pillars from a little child, and we do get to where we want to go because of Brother Russell. It's not because of our own sight.
Okay. I tend to like personally the thoughts that Joy suggests, that no picture can cover all points. In the very natural picture, the blindness here was something that was very reversible. It was, the eyes were literally removed, and therefore it could not have been restored, and that was not the point of the picture. The point of the picture was to regain strength, and the emphasis at the end is strength and not sight. But it could be suggestive, as Alice and Richard have mentioned, of another interpretation of Samson throughout. That I think we should take up as an option as we finish the option discussed first in the paragraphs. Now he's suggesting that the feast at the temple, this feast of Dagon that they held, represents what? Joe?
Feasting on error, learning error instead of truth.
Okay. Why a feast? Joe?
Well, I guess in those days, ever since the time of the end began, men were hungry for knowledge. And particularly more recently, the increase of knowledge, the desire for knowledge in all aspects has been a part of mankind's history. And so now, as our pastor saw it in his day, there was an intense desire for this higher criticism and evolutionary theories, a quest for knowledge that was, of course, erroneous and overthrew the truth of God.
Okay. Now, there's the suggesting there's a rejoicing over the newfound information, the newfound, because evolution of his day, you know, and the things that would support a scientific explanation of everything, a non-God explanation. He said, therefore, they rejoiced over this. They feasted over it. And now he suggests in the article that the church enters in and does what? Oh, Violet, I'm sorry. I missed your comment.
I wasn't going to answer your question, but I like that expression, God of evolution, because whenever I watch television and listen to them preach evolution, I keep thinking it's a religion. So I think the expression God of evolution is appropriate.
Okay. Now, how does the true church figure into the destruction feature here? What does he suggest is the role of the true church? Ali?
You know, he had his arms put by these two pillars, which pictured the Old and the New Testament restored. So, and these people were probably wine drinking, and they had all these false doctrines. And the truth came out to destroy all these doctrines.
Okay, and he mentioned several specifics that were very real in his time about the activities going on, you know, within the harvest movement, the volunteer work, the call porter work, the pilgrim work. And then he just groups the rest. He said, 1,000 other energies. What are some of the thousands of other energies that can be used in this throwing down the pillars of error? Gilbert?
I was thinking humility would be a strong factor.
in overcoming human ego.
Okay. It can almost be shown by the fact at that time he was just blending his background already. Anyone else? Ted?
I think Brother Russell was one to look for ways to promote the truth in whatever came about. He used many different methods whenever he saw it available. And so I think this was an allusion to things that he hadn't thought about or that might still be developed. And I think that that's a reasonable thing. We see he had no idea of radio programs or television programs or multimedia showings. So he was saying that there were other ways that he had not thought about or knew about to spread the truth.
That's what I like in this. I think it's a real incentive to be energetic in thinking of the thousands of other ways and using them. He said, reach out for what's in your hand and find a way to use it to apply it to the energies that are there. Before we leave the first side, let's take up the option that's been suggested. I want to have Richard start us in this discussion. Richard, is your thought then that throughout his life, Samson pictures natural Israel or only in the closing experiences?
Well, Brother Carl, I just wanted to suggest that the friends could turn it over in their minds. Certainly we appreciate the thoughts that the pastor presents in the reprints. When we look at Samson's life, we find that he was consecrated to the Lord from birth, the same as Israel, and had strength, but went to whoring, the same as Israel, and was blinded and mocked of the Gentiles, the same as Israel. And in the final destruction of the Gentiles, he's still blind, the same as Israel. But he has the strength from the Lord through prayer to bring down that old order so that in his death, he killed more than he did in his life. And the death of Israel there is not their destruction as a nation, but rather their death as unbelieving Samson, because that's what I understand to be tied in with the scriptures that refer to the purging out of the rebels. After that, you have a new Israel, which now will know that Jehovah is their Lord and that Jesus was his son.
Okay, Alice, do you think, Ned, because you mentioned also you like that basic thought of Israel, any further comments that would add to that?
Well, that what was said plus, the church class did all of this drowsiness, really the church class didn't. They were taken by wings in the wilderness. So I think that that element of the true church really never did all these things that Samson did, unless we say it's the false church, maybe.
Okay. The thought then that Israel is also used of the Lord in the pulling down of the old order, and they do it in their blindness. They return in blindness. That very term is used of Israel, and there's more of a drowsiness there. Any additional thoughts as to Israel versus the true church in the Samson picture? Okay, we've got the two etched, and maybe as we now picking up the clues, and we're going to be basically studying this from the perspective of the article, but keep in Israel in mind too, keep the other options in mind as you're going through the lessons of the different parts. Marge?
I was going to say it doesn't necessarily have to be either or. There may be certain aspects of the picture that apply best to the church and certain aspects of the picture of Samson that apply to natural Israel. It may be a case of one and the other interpretation.
This can very well be true. Often you have a theme of variations. You have a lesson drawn from one aspect and then from another. I remember when we were studying the pyramid at Brother Edmund Jesuit's home many years ago, Brother Morehouse was leading the study. And we had a lot of comments from the conflict between Brother Edgar's concept and Brother Russell's concept in the chronology. And I always liked the principle he set forth. He said, both of these concepts are good, but don't mix them. He said, let's take one concept, study it through, and then take the other concept and study it through and get the lessons from each. That was very profitable. Going back now to the birth of, yes, Noe.
Could the blindness be when the true church was still with the nominal systems? And then when Pastor Russell says, come out of her, my people, Well, then you're separating the blindness from the true church.
I think that is what he is suggesting in that first quotation, that he's talking about the church during the age prior to the harvest, that he found that they were in a blinded condition, that they had permitted themselves to be have their sight removed. Okay, Sue?
Not only that, but Pastor Russell many times in the reprints gives double applications to a set of scriptures. And I was just trying to find quickly in the book of Isaiah, I remember when we were studying it, I'm sorry, I can't find it at the moment, but Pastor Russell takes one chapter and applies it to Israel, and then that same chapter he says, no, this is the gospel age church, in another reprint. So to say that you know, there are two different interpretations doesn't imply that either one is wrong.
Yeah, there are lessons from each. There's a good saying, I think, that's true in so many of scriptures. All scripture has many applications, even though one interpretation, that there can be many ways in which a text can be applied. In fact, with that in mind, let's just skip down to the last quotation first before we take up the body of the study. Because here you've got a third suggestion as to Samson. And this is taken from the photodrama. It's the quotation on the back side. Marta, do you have the sheet there? Okay, would you read that small, short quotation there, even now?
Even now, labor like the blind giant Samson is groping for the pillars whose fall will overthrow present conditions. It's taken from Photodrama 89.
Okay. Can we just get a few comments on how that picture fits in? That's another picture Brother Russell draws. He, quite different than the one of the church. He says, like labor. Joe?
I think in Pastor Russell's day, he saw labor, the workers being oppressed by the rich business owners, the rich company owners, the trusts, and so forth, as he wrote in the fourth volume. And so in this analogy, he's likening them to the Philistines. And, of course, Pastor Russell saw the oppression of the poor laborers, and he was more or less on their side, likening them to Samson. And he saw coming the struggle between the rich and the poor, which would eventually topple the entire order, pictured by Samson toppling the pillars of the temple to Dagon.
Okay. Any other comments on that? Ted?
I think we have to remember in Brother Russell's day that the labor movement was just coming to life, and he saw it growing into a giant that would have a conflict with management or with business. And so in many places he mentioned that that would be the basis for the final conflict between labor and business.
To me, it's amazing some of the things that you read in the writings of Brother Russell about labor. And I think Brother Ted gives us the clue of how to understand them. And that is to realize that he's writing about labor at a far different period than we're seeing labor. He's seeing labor as the very much the cry of the oppressed. Those that had been really held down. Now we see labor infiltrated with corruption and the unions, their pension funds almost ruling capital in some cases. But it's interesting. Here is a capitalist, and that's what Brother Russell was by nature. He owned businesses. Very strongly on the side of labor as a call of justice. And that he's seeing they're a blinded element, it's partly through their own folly, and yet they're an element that he saw in many sense where the Lord's hand was. That's why he calls them the Lord's great army, and as a main phalanx of that army. I think that covers, I think we can all recognize the labor picture he's illustrating is a secondary picture. That's not his primary picture. He never tries to carry all of Samson's life through into the labor picture. He makes an application as an illustration of something. Whereas in the picture of the reprint 4088, he's dealing with the whole of Samson's life. Okay, with this clue, now let's go back and pick up the individual elements. We're not going to have time to go very far. I wish we would get at least into the first of the women, because one of the reasons I like the true church for Samson is the true church is involved with three women, three churches. The nominal Jewish church, the Catholic Church, and the Protestant Church. And they seem to parallel very well with the experiences that Samson has. But we only have time, I think, to get into the parts leading up to maybe the beginning of the woman of Timnath. Samson's miraculous birth, Judges 13:1-3. Paula, would you read those verses for us?
And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. And there was a certain man of Zorah of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and bare not. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman and said unto her, Behold now, thou art barren, and bearest not, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son.
Okay, there's not a lot of detail in here, but what lessons can be drawn from the birth? There should be at least one obvious lesson, maybe more than that. Sophie?
It was a miraculous birth.
Miraculous in what sense?
In that she was unable to conceive and the Lord made it possible.
Okay, and that's reminiscent of what other women in the Bible?
Samuel's mother.
Okay, Samuel's mother, you had the same instance. Sarah, you had the same instance. Many more are the children of the barren than of the her that hath a wife. Here you've got the almost a Hagar-Sarah contrast again. He takes the woman who is the barren one, and here is the seed of the barren by miracle. It's one thing that does tie in with this theory very well, the church, because they are the seed of the barren. Additional comments on this birth. I don't think there's too much other detail given about the birth. Okay, the second area, there's more detail, the vow that he's born under. 4 to 14, rather long section. Florence Tabak, would you read that for us?
Now therefore beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come on his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Then the woman came and told her husband, saying, A man of God came unto me, and his countenance was like the countenance of an angel of God, very terrible. But I asked him not whence he was, neither told he me his name. But he said unto me, Behold, thou shalt conceive and bear a son. And now drink no wine nor strong drink, neither eat any unclean thing. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, O my Lord, let the man of God which thou didst send come again unto us, and teach us what we shall do unto the child that shall be born. And God hearkened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again unto the woman as she sat in the field. But Manoah her husband was not with her. And the woman made haste, and ran, and showed her husband, and said unto him, Behold, the man hath appeared unto me that came unto me the other day. And Manoah arose and went after his wife, and came to the man, and said unto him, Art thou the man that spakest unto the woman? And he said, I am. And Manoah said, Now let thy words come to pass. How shall we order the child, and how shall we do unto him? And the angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, Of all that I said unto the woman, let her beware. She may not eat of anything that cometh of the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. All that I commanded her, let her observe.
Okay, what comments can you make about the Nazarite vow as the source of her strength? His strength. I should call on George Tabak for the answer to that one. I think you have a talk on the Nazarite vow, don't you, George? George, why don't you just sort of give us a little bit of a quick synopsis.
Well, all the various aspects were beautifully symbolic of the life of a consecrated Christian. The Nazarite couldn't drink any wine, and perhaps in this case being symbolic of the things of the earth that are refreshing that could hinder the new creature. In fact, he couldn't even not only just drink wine, he couldn't even eat of the grapes nor the seed of the grapes. So even the very thoughts, the promises of what can come forth must be completely rid of any of the desires of the things of the world. And, of course, we talked about also the hair not being cut completely, always recognizing God as our headship. And he was to come not in contact with any dead bodies, even if it be the death of a father or mother or family member. He had to remain apart. And so we must have a complete separateness from anything to do with sin in the consecrated life.
Okay. So really it spells out consecration vows very beautifully. And that consecration vows are the source of strength to the church. Without that, there is no strength. And you notice, Walter Drake.
It's rather interesting from the chapter 13, the fifth verse, when you view that with the 14th verse and the fourth verse. And that is, on one hand, when the angel told the parents that they would conceive, would have a son, and he would deliver Israel out of the Philistines. But on the fourth and the following chapter, it says, but his father and mother knew not that it was the Lord. So it's one thing to be have the promises of the Lord, but not yet know in what direction that one would take to take and establish, or else take and follow up on what the Lord would have us do.
Yes, I think that's a very strong key, to always recognize that the real key to Samson's life is 14:4, is that what was done is not what seems on the surface, but the intention behind it to seek an occasion against the Philistines. You notice that even before he was born, his mother had to keep the same vow, that it was not only incumbent upon Samson, but even the pre-Samson period. And if we do look at it from the standpoint of the article as the church, notice how the church is born out of Israel. And even upon Israel, it was incumbent that these same restrictions be there, that they seek to have this separateness from the world and have this vow, until the church was born, and then they were cast off.